This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Jeff Patak, Global Director of Manager Research for Morningstar Research Services.
And I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance for Morningstar.
Our guest in the podcast today is Mark Miller, a nationally recognized expert on trends in retirement and aging. Mark's work considers retirement holistically, including healthcare and Medicare, Social Security, retirement investing, midlife careers, and housing. Mark is a regular contributor to Morningstar.com, and he also writes about retirement matters for Reuters, the New York Times, and WealthManagement.com. Mark has also written several books, including The Hard Times Guide to Retirement Security, and his most recent book, Jolt, Stories of Trauma and Transformation. Additionally, Mark has his own podcast and newsletter, both of which are called Retirement Revised. Mark, welcome to The Long View.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
So maybe before we talk about whether there is a looming retirement crisis, which is a debate that continues to rage, maybe sort of a good baseline place to start is talking about how we even measure that. You know, are there particular data points that you would look at in making an assessment of maybe the overall state of retirement readiness before we get to the conclusion part of that? What do you look at?
Well, you know, I think a great way to look at it is retirement income. You know, just how much income are people able to replace in retirement? I think that's a simple measure, whether that's coming from Social Security or a pension or saving. I think that's, you know, a very simple way to just say, are people going to have enough to get along in retirement?
So when you look at that data, focusing on that data point, what do you see? Because we've had some people, including on this podcast, who have said, well, it's not that much worse going forward than it was in past decades, that people are in okay shape. What's your vantage point on
that? I find it hard to generalize. I dislike the term retirement crisis because I think it implies sort of a, you know, a looming wall we're going to hit, you know, an immediacy, like an event. And I don't think it is that. I think it's a rolling situation, and I think it varies tremendously depending which, you know, demographic group you're looking at. You can do it generationally or otherwise. But I think it is fair to say that, you know, you've got probably about a third of households, give or take, that are going to be just fine in retirement between probably high Social Security payments, maybe a defined benefit pension, and high savings. And then you've got another two-thirds that are, you know, lots of them are going to be living only on Social Security, which typically replaces, you know, 40%-ish of income. So, you know, that implies a sharp drop. At least, you know, maybe there are two Social Security payments coming to that household for a married couple, so that's pretty good. But I worry about households that are going to just be living on Social Security. So I think it's a very much of a mixed bag in terms of readiness.
So let's tackle it generationally, starting with the older cohort of retirees today, the so-called silent generation. That group were pretty good savers, right? How did they fare in terms of, of their retirements?
And with the caveat that I think it's difficult to generalize, but I think if you want to look at that generation, they are better off than succeeding generations simply because they're more likely to have a defined benefit pension. They benefited from years and years of run-up in the real estate market. Boomers have too, I think. They are not experiencing the cuts in Social Security that were set in motion in 1983, and we can discuss that in more detail if you like. Probably more likely to have a defined benefit pension. So, you know, I think as a generation, they're better off, and I think basically it kind of goes downhill from there incrementally. You know, boomers, again, I split boomers into two groups, the older and the younger segment.
Okay.
The older boomers are probably more like silents from this perspective. They share a lot of the same characteristics that I just mentioned.
So they have pensions.
Yeah, again, more likely to. You know, this is a misnomer out there that defined benefit pensions don't exist anymore. It's just false. You know, like these older cohorts are more likely to have them. And even though most corporations have frozen their plans, that doesn't mean that they're not still paying out benefits to people who were promised them over the years. So that's a very slow-moving decline. And it's one of the reasons why younger cohorts are, I think, facing more challenges because defined benefit pensions, along with Social Security, I think have been well demonstrated to do the best job of providing retirement security, full stop.
So older boomers in better shape. Let's talk about the younger boomers.
Yeah, probably a bit less likely to have a DB pension, are going to be hit to some extent by the cuts in Social Security that were put in motion in 83. And, you know, I think saving is a varying story. Some have saved very well. I would put that one-third, two-third measure onto that. One-third are probably just fine from a saving standpoint. Boomers, as I mentioned, also have done pretty well in the real estate market. They were buying before the big run-ups started.
How about the younger cohorts then, the Gen X and millennials?
Yeah, that's where it starts to get dicier. So, you know, in 1983, Social Security reforms were put in place that started this slow-moving increase in the retirement age from 65 to 67. And those are fully in place in, I believe it's 2022. And so, you know, the younger you go, the more impacted you are by that. And it's oftentimes not understood that higher retirement ages are, in fact, a benefit cut. The way it often gets discussed is we're all living longer, therefore it only makes sense to raise the Social Security age. Well, not everybody's living longer, first off. But second, what raising the age does is raises the bar of what it takes to get a full benefit. So by the time this is fully phased in, filing at 65 will be about 13% less valuable than it was before the changes began, is an easy way to put it. So it's like a 13% benefit cut between the 65 to 67. That's pretty significant. So Gen Xers, millennials, and successive generations will be increasingly affected by those cuts as they come into retirement. So I think that's a big concern. They're very much less likely to have a defined benefit pension coming. Real estate, young folks today coming into that market that's already run up quite a bit. You look at student debt and the problems that people are having with student debt. So I think you look at the big macro picture, and I think the younger down you go, it's more challenging. I don't buy into this idea that, young people don't care about this stuff. They're not paying attention to it. I don't think that's right at all. You look at the FIRE movement, for example. Now, granted, that's maybe kind of a niche
kind
movement.
Of maybe a rarefied subset, right?
But nonetheless, you know, there's this group of people that are, you know, obsessed with saving. Good on them. I don't notice this among millennials in my kids are in that cohort, and I talk to them and their friends all the time about this stuff, and they ask me about it. You know, what do I do about retirement? What should I be doing? And they're interested. They want to do the right thing. I just think younger cohorts are going to have a, you know, bigger hill to climb in a lot of ways.
We've talked about this generationally, but, you know, maybe another way to look at it is male versus female, and particularly looking at, you know, single women, perhaps they were widowed, right? And it seems like that's a particularly at-risk cohort. And so the question is, why is that? You know, and is it better or worse for single women, baby boomers, than perhaps it was for silent generation women? Is that a noticeable trend as well?
So a fundamental thing is that women still tend to spend more years out of the workforce. And so that reverberates in all kinds of ways. They're out for caregiving purposes typically, whether it's for kids or elderly parents. So that spills over into all the things we've been talking about. You accrue less Social Security credit. You probably are saving less for retirement. You might have less liquid saving, which is another, you know, I think, critical issue out there. Women tend to live longer than men. So you're looking at less resources stretched over more time. You asked about single versus married. Sure. I mean, for married couples, Social Security has all kinds of nifty features in there that can boost household benefits, you know, the spousal benefit, the survivor benefit. If you're single, you know, you're on your own record, your own earning record. So, yes, I think it's probably more challenging for single women, but I'm sure you've discussed on your podcast before, there's a lot of just general underlying infrastructure differences for women as opposed to men. If I could put it that way, it's probably not a good way to put it.
What would some of those be?
Well, I do think it's the earnings gap.
Yeah.
And I think it's the years out of the workforce. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't buy this idea that women are somehow less focused on these issues. I'm very skeptical about all those. I'm always skeptical about finger pointing.
Right.
I look really hard at those ideas that, oh, if only people took the time to understand these things better and focused on it more and, you know, paid more attention. I'm just like, I don't think so.
So it doesn't sound like you'd think that women investing too conservatively has had a big role in this.
Well, they might be right about that.
Yeah.
For all I know.
Yeah. One comment I sometimes hear in relation to retirement adequacy is the fact that people's spending tends to trend down as they age.
Yeah.
And so the question is, do we know that that is by choice or is it out of necessity? I guess, how do you unpack that question? And do you think that that argues for the fact that people will have enough in retirement knowing that they will spend less later on?
Yeah, I think there's some good research out there suggesting that, you know, discretionary spending tends to fall with age. You know, there's the early years of retirement, people tend to travel and do a lot of entertaining and all the rest. And as their health starts to fail, they pull in their horns. They're not doing as much of that. But then there, of course, is the other end of the risk, which is healthcare spending starts to rise. So it can be U-shaped.
Right.
We're probably there talking more about the affluent households that have choices, right?
Right.
So it's not a straight line. I think, you know, David Blanchett has demonstrated that pretty well in his research. Others, I think Wade Fowle, have done really good work on that, saying that this whole idea of you just draw a straight line of spending is probably not right.
So maybe to put this into a broader historical context, we've talked about some of the distinctions in readiness, let's call it, between, you know, people of a certain age or characteristic. But if we were to maybe back up, you know, a decade, two decades, and have the same sort of conversation. Let's imagine ourselves doing that. Do we imagine that the conversation would have sounded a lot different and that that things have truly eroded in terms of retirement readiness?
Well, to the extent that we've moved from this more automatic system to a much more self-driven system, yes.
Okay.
I mean, I think two of the things that are terrific about Social Security and defined benefit pensions is that they are so automatic and they work
right.
in the background.
Right.
And I don't think there's any debating that those are the most successful sources of retirement asset. I mean, Social Security, most people are hardly even aware that they're paying into it. I remember during the Great Recession, there was a payroll tax holiday for, I forget if it was a year or 2 years, where they stopped collecting as a way to stimulate the economy. And a survey was done after the taxes went back into place, and most people were not aware that they had stopped being collected and they were not aware that they had started being collected again. So it's just one of those things that goes on in the background. Now, you know, you can argue that the filing side of Social Security is not quite so automatic because you have these kind of interesting decisions you can make about when to claim and all the rest. Mm-hmm. But I would argue that's still a lot less complicated than, say, the world of investing. And the same with defined benefit pension. You know, the employer is contributing to it. You don't even have to really think much about it. You get to retirement, so, you know, your checks start. You know, this whole idea of self-directed retirement, this is the experiment we've been running and living in since the 80s, really. And as we've been discussing, it's had really mixed results. Some people are great at it, really roll up their sleeves, love it, getting into this stuff. But I think it's a relatively small part of the population. And we see the efforts to make even that side more automatic, produce results.
Yeah.
You know, automatic enrollment, mm-hmm. automatic escalation, target date funds. Those mm-hmm. things seem mm-hmm. to produce good results. So
okay.
the message to me is people writ large are not interested in this stuff, not capable of getting their heads around it. I'm talking about the investing stuff.
Sure.
And not going to do it. And then you have the issue of forcing people to think about what they're going to be doing decades in the future. You know, from a behavioral standpoint, it is so difficult. And this plays out in all kinds of ways. You know, we've talked about, Christine, we've talked many times about long-term care.
Right.
And how you can't get people to think about that stuff. I think, you
it's
know, saving.
Right.
Yeah. Saving can be the same way. You know, immediate needs are front and center. I'm worried about raising my kids. Maybe I'm thinking about saving for their college, paying the mortgage. What am I doing about my student debt? There's a lot of stuff that's right in front of people. You know, the data about the lack of liquid savings, people living paycheck to paycheck. And we want to come along and talk to them about the importance of retirement saving. That's a tough haul.
Right.
So I'm, you know, one who is in favor of a more automated and, yes, even paternalistic system. And I know that gets into areas of ideology and this whole notion of, you know, we worship at the altar of choice. And people need to have choices, right? And yeah, I guess that's right. But isn't the evidence pretty clear that in many cases, less choice is producing better outcomes? Like the Federal Thrift Savings Program, which has, what, five choices on the menu?
And target date options
yeah.
or life cycle options.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. So I'm really skeptical about that whole ideology of choice.
Mark, one trend that you follow closely in your work is older adults working longer, in some cases well past retirement age. So let's talk about the key factors driving that trend.
Yeah.
Longer life expectancies, better health, financial need due to the ebbing away of pensions, all of the above.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the underlying factors.
Sure. Well, I think those are the factors. I think there's been a lot of messaging around the importance of working longer. And people like me have been writing about it now for 10 or 15 years, and you hear about this all the time. And there's a lot of people out there who are just convinced that they'll never retire. So I am a believer that working longer can be a great strategy if you can pull it off.
You always call it an aspiration, but not a plan.
Mean, look, it's a no-brainer in this sense. If it enables you to delay filing for Social Security and getting those delayed retirement credits, if it enables you to save more, if it enables you to live off of wage income rather than drawing down savings for even a few years, it's like the biggest inflection point out there that you can make for people. So it's great to do. The problem is that it's risky as a strategy. You know, the studies show that about 37% of workers retire earlier than they planned, either through job loss or it could be a health problem. Or actually, one thing that's interesting is that the study that I'm referencing here from the Center on Retirement Research at Boston College, and I talked to the researchers about their finding. Those are the two that always come up, job loss, health. But the researchers actually said to me, you know, a lot of the people who did this, it was much harder to pin down what the reason was. Were they just bored? Were they just ready for something different? They wanted to be with the grand, you know, sort of a more ineffable reasons that they gave up on working. So 37% are retiring earlier than they planned, and the odds of reaching the goal are lower the more ambitious the goal. So if I plan to work to 70, I'm much less likely to reach that than if my goal is to work to 66. So it's a risky plan. So when I have people saying to me, oh, you know, I don't have anything saved, but I'll be okay because I just plan to work forever, I say, well, you know, your chances of doing that aren't really that high. So that's what worries me about it. Then you say, well, you need a plan B. And the answers there aren't all that great. Well, it's like save as much as you can.
Right.
It's funny. I did a story about this for the Sunday New York Times retiring column a couple months ago. And that was the suggestion as far as a plan B. It's like save as much as you can. And the comments from readers really were all over me for that. What do you mean telling me to save? I'm struggling with A, B, C, D, and E. I can't do that, you know. So there's a lot of anger out there about a lot of these issues. And so I don't know what else to say, though. What is a plan B if you haven't saved, you know?
Right. What do the data say, Mark? You talked about some of the financial benefits of sticking it out in the workforce longer.
Yeah.
Are there any other benefits that we're able to quantify, or is it just sort of inextricably intertwined that if you're healthy, you're more likely to be able to continue to work?
And well, staying engaged is good for people. I think it's good for their health, their mental well-being, you know, feeling a sense of purpose. I think there's all kinds of intangible benefits to it. But the financial benefits are really pretty impressive. I mean, just take Social Security and the benefit of a delayed filing. So to review the bidding right now, the full retirement age is 66. That's when you're entitled to 100% of your benefit. And for every additional 12 months you wait, that's about 8% additional monthly income up to age 70 when the additional credits are no longer available. So what you're buying is 8% more of inflation-adjusted income. I just finished a piece, hasn't quite run yet, about inflation and talking about how this is sort of an underappreciated risk out there because we've been living with such low inflation for such a long time. But even inflation of 2 or 3% compounds out to a pretty noticeable drop in spending power. And if inflation starts to spike up at some point, which, you know, the Fed seems to maybe be a little worried about right now, it gets to be an even bigger deal. So I think the cost of living adjustment in Social Security is kind of an underappreciated feature of the program. It's really the only inflation hedge out there. There's literally one CPI-adjusted annuity provider out there, the principal. They're the only ones offering something that's CPI-adjusted on annuities. You can buy a flat rate increase SPIA. You know, pick your number, 1%.
Single premium immediate annuity.
But that's not exactly an inflation hedge. It's just kind of a guess, right? Stocks aren't literally an inflation hedge. They, over time, can kind of keep you even or ahead. But they're actually not correlated with inflation short term, so they're not an inflation hedge, literally. So Social Security is the inflation protection out there. So back to where we were, I don't know where else you could buy an inflation-protected annuity, if you will, at that price by delaying your filing for a couple of years. What's the cost? The cost is either drawing down savings to live or using wage income to live, as we're discussing. That, to me, is a great strategy of buying inflation protection and higher income in retirement.
But delaying isn't the right strategy for everyone.
No, of
right?
course not. Yeah. And thanks for saying that. I think it's always an important thing to say. There can be lots of reasons to file earlier. You know, you need the income, or you have reasons to think your life expectancy won't be that good.
Right.
Having said that, I think one trap people fall into is this kind of break-even analysis on Social Security. A lot of people like to think about Social Security from the break-even standpoint. And to me, not the best way to think about it. I'd rather encourage people to think about the longevity insurance aspect of it. And most of us don't know how long we'll live. And so to say, well, I'm only going to live to 78, so therefore I'm going to file early and get my money out. Yeah, well, you might live to 85 or 90, or your spouse might live to 95 or 100 and receive the survivor benefit. So I prefer that, but I get asked the question about break-even a lot, so I answer it, but you know, I don't think it's the preferred way to do it.
Another comment I sometimes hear is, well, I'm concerned about Social Security solvency, so I'm getting mine while I can, even if it's 62 at a greatly reduced benefit.
It's a big one. It's really big. I think it's the biggest question people ask me about Social Security is, will it be there for me in the future?
Right.
So here's how I look at that. Social Security is facing a shortfall. We're on course to have the trust funds for the retirement and disability programs that are usually looked at combined. Those trust funds will be exhausted in 2035, according to the latest projection. Think of the trust funds as sort of the excess in the checking account. All the money that comes into Social Security goes into the trust funds, and then they pay benefits out of it. So there's a lot of in-go, out-go there. And the excess, there's a almost $3 trillion in reserves right now in the trust funds, but we're starting to draw it down as the boomer retirement wave accelerates, and for some other reasons. One key reason is that we've seen softness in wage growth. We've seen more income escaping the cap on the amount of wages subject to taxation. And probably another really critical reason is the change in the ratio of younger people coming in as workers to older people retiring. So the drop in fertility rates in the U.S. plays a role there as well. When we get to 2035 and that trust fund is exhausted, that's the point at which Social Security would only pay out 80% of promised or scheduled benefits. So it's basically an across-the-board 20% cut benefits. It'd be a total disaster. I mean, the way I look at this is, I think the chances of reaching that point are slim to none, and it's a very simple reason. You look at the popularity of Social Security across the board in the United States. You know, the support for the program by the public is really strong. Politicians know this. Members of Congress know this. I cannot imagine a member of Congress wanting to go back to his or her district at that point and explain a 20% cut in Social Security benefits. So something is going to get done to avert that. The questions are, when will we get to it, and what do we do? Now, oftentimes you'll hear a comment made, well, you know, Congress isn't focused on this. Nobody's even talking about it. We got to get Congress focused on it. The reality, I like to point out, is that there is a very credible, solid piece of legislation under consideration in the House right now. It doesn't have a chance of passing the Republican-controlled Senate or being signed by the president, but nonetheless, there's a bill on the table that just got its first full hearing in the House Ways and Means Committee. I understand it's going to get a vote on the floor of the House this fall that puts the program back into 75-year actuarial balance. By law, Social Security is required to project its finances 75 years in the future, which is kind of crazy if you think about it. It's interesting. You know, what other program of this type would be projecting? But that's what the law says, so that's what we do. This bill would put the program back on track and even provide some modest expansion of benefits, mostly for lower income households. And it does it by raising the payroll tax rate 0.1% per year for, I think it's 15 years. And then it also adds a new layer of tax for very high income households. Households with ordinary income over $400,000 would start paying payroll tax rates again on income over 400. So almost a donut hole. You know, as I was mentioning earlier, that survey about how people never even noticed when taxes weren't collected and when they started up again. I mean, nobody's going to notice a 0.1% increase in what they're paying into the system, and they're paying in for their own futures. So this is a good bill. I mean, I hope that it's good. Something like this is what we'll do. I mean, the alternative is to cut benefits or to do some mix of new taxes and benefit cuts. But I hope we don't cut benefits because, as we've been discussing, there's lots and lots of households that are on thin ice with retirement to start with. Social Security is a modest benefit to start with, and I don't think we should be cutting it. Now, you'll hear people say, well, you know, rich people don't need Social Security. Warren Buffett doesn't need Social Security. And that's true. Warren Buffett doesn't need Social Security, but how many Warren Buffetts are there? So even if you said, let's not pay benefits out to rich people like Warren Buffett, it doesn't have any meaningful impact on the program's finances. There just aren't enough of those folks. And I would argue forcefully that for mass affluent households, Social Security is a really important source of retirement income. Ask any financial planner what happens when they pull Social Security out of the plan for their clients, and it's not pretty.
Yeah, Mark Balassa, the financial planner here in Chicago, once joked he pulled it out for clients, and they were like, okay, yeah, put it back in.
Right, I remember him saying that at one of the Morningstar conferences, and I was laughing. I said, yeah, it is really ugly.
But from a planning standpoint, Mark, how should people who are maybe 20, 30 years from retirement think about this? If you are a higher income household, is it reasonable to haircut your benefit by what, 20-30% in expectation that there might be some adjustment?
You mean if you don't buy the Mark Miller line that it's not going to happen, that the cuts aren't going to happen?
Well, if I just want to be cautious.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you can do that. But it's, you know, you've just made your hill steeper and more difficult to climb. You know, you can do that.
In terms of my savings.
But when a reader is asking you for advice, like, you know, how should I approach this if I really am not convinced? Like, what would you advise?
I mean, if they really push back after I've given my song and dance about Congress, I say, yeah, okay, you know, hedge your bets a little bit. Can't hurt, right? You're just being conservative.
And so then the conversation becomes, okay, you got to save a little bit more. Yeah. You got to work a little bit longer.
Exactly.
Exactly.
I mean, there's no free lunch there. So if you want to shave your Social Security, you want to do it with the assumption that it only starts in 2035, right?
Yeah.
Not a simple exercise because you'd have to project out your benefit to that point and then with the COLAs and then start assuming some cuts. Right. The further out you get in the future, it gets a little harder. But yeah, I don't have any problem with it if people are that convinced that Congress is going to allow a 20% cut in Social Security benefits.
Yeah.
You know, predicting the future is always hard the further out you get down the road.
Right.
I just don't see it happening.
Yeah.
Mark, before we leave the topic of working longer, I'd like to discuss what the job market is like for older adults. Age discrimination is a thing. Can you talk about what the landscape is like for people who are wishing and able to stick it out past what in the past we thought of as kind of traditional retirement age?
I think it's widely acknowledged that age discrimination is still a thing. You know, legal protections for it have eroded, if anything. You know, you hear the stories all the time from people, not just in their 60s, but at younger ages, too. Depends on the industry. Like, you know, Silicon Valley is sort of notorious for this. You know, you're old at 40. So age discrimination is certainly an issue. Some of the people I know, colleagues of mine and journalists who write in this field are a little more optimistic about this than I am, pointing to signs of employers starting to do more to accommodate older workers with things like flexible scheduling and the like. And I think you can find examples of that. But when you step back and look at the macro level of this, you know, I think it can still be challenging. You have to look at age discrimination. Two sides of that coin is one is security if you have a job. The other is job hunting. And both are challenging. You hear all the time from workers who have lost jobs and just can't get a hearing. And, you know, again, going back to this, you know, idea of relying on working longer as a retirement plan, this is one of the main problems I have with it.
I remember one thing you wrote about for us in the wake of the financial crisis was just sort of how job prospects looked for older adults during that period. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but the takeaway was that older adults kept their jobs at a higher rate than younger subsets, but when they lost them, it took them much longer to replace them.
Right. It's gotten, I mean, it's better now with the labor market being so much tighter than it was. I keep waiting, though, to see the evidence of a big sea change in demand for older workers, and I haven't seen it. And the unemployment rates for older workers actually are about a point lower than the general unemployment rate. And there's a variety of reasons for that. That's always been, as long as I've been tracking this, it's always been the case. But when you look at the average time out of work, that's where you kind of see this. It's much higher for older workers than it is for younger. It's just much harder to get reemployed.
Right. One ongoing debate in the retirement planning community is what length of retirement to plan for. Mm-hmm. I had Joel Dixon and Maria Bruno from Vanguard on a couple of weeks ago, and Joel argued that using the 30-year horizon for everyone and in every situation does pre-retirees kind of a disservice, that it could encourage oversaving and underspending. What's your take on that question, time horizon in retirement? How should people plan?
Yeah, I get the argument about planning to 100 because it's sort of a nice conservative number that I think a lot of planners like for that reason. But I think it needs to be framed the right way. Like when I talk with our planner, she's always pushing us towards the edge of very conservative assumptions. And as long as I understand that they're very conservative assumptions, well, that's okay. Because then I say, well, you know, I'm actually probably a little ahead of where this looks. You know, the flip side is, I mean, you cut the assumption from what, 100 to 85? I mean, a lot of people are going to make it past 85, so I think you do a disservice there. So I understand those concerns, but I don't fundamentally have a big problem with a conservative number so long as it's couched and understood properly. Again, we're talking about here people who have relationships with planners. Mm-hmm. That's a relatively small part of the population. So one concern here would be if somebody's using an online tool and just plugging in numbers, do they understand what's being spit back at them properly?
Speaking of online tools, are there any that you really like for forecasting retirement readiness?
Well, there's some that I like for Social Security in particular.
What are those?
Social Security Solutions is a nice set of online tools, pretty easy to use. The Social Security website has a lot of really useful tools as well. I haven't run into all that much that I think is sort of a single holistic tool for doing your plan online that I have said, yeah, this is the thing. I really haven't run across that.
How about life expectancy calculators? Yeah. Do you like any of those?
Yeah, there's one that the Society of Actuaries has that's good because it's quite simple. They just ask you to plug in two or three data points, and it comes back and says, here's your range. The folks at the SOA, Society of Actuaries, argue, I think, persuasively that these more complex online tools are kind of doing a disservice because they give people a sense that they're giving more certainty about life expectancy than perhaps is really possible.
So if you use these tools and you realize that you're facing a shortfall, what do you think somebody mm-hmm. should do? I realize that counsel can vary yeah. depending on sort of where they are and
right.
sort of their circumstances.
Yeah.
But, I mean, are there a sort of a common set of vectors or considerations
sure.
for those folks?
Well, I think two sides of the equation. One, we've already explored it. It's in some depth, which is strategies like working longer, delayed Social Security, saving more. You
right.
know, there's the catch-up contribution allowances, which if you're in a position to do that, I think are great.
Yep.
Health savings accounts, if you have access to one. And again, if you're in a financial position at this late point, to sock some money into that, mm-hmm. great. Mm-hmm. You know, I think an ideal thing with an HSA is if you can max it out and then not use it in a given year. To meet your health care, you've really done yourself a favor. But again, I think it's a relatively small number of households that are financially positioned to do that stuff.
Let's just quick walk through the tax benefits of the HSA, why they're so attractive, because it does seem like people like you really love HSAs above any of the other retirement savings vehicles because the tax benefits.
Well, let me clarify. I don't love HSAs above all other.
Okay.
I think they number one, I think, and Morningstar research has shown this, they're kind of mediocre as investment platforms, right?
Some can be, yeah.
Some can be. The tax benefits, let's just stipulate, are unmatched, right?
Right.
It's basically you put the money in pre-tax, and as long as you use it for a healthcare need, it doesn't get taxed. Hard to argue that that's not a great thing. Most households, though, are not going to – there's a relatively small number of households that are using them so far in the way that I just suggested because they can't. I mean – you put the money in and you wind up using it for a healthcare need in the current year. So as a saving vehicle, I don't think we've seen a lot of evidence yet that they're a great vehicle, with the exception of very high income households that can afford to max out the HSA and then not touch it.
Right.
So, you know, to me, the 401k, the Roth, the IRA are just more, you know, every person's retirement vehicle still. But yeah, HSA, if you have the resources, there's no doubt that that's a great additional opportunity. But I would never say that I love it above all else. And the other thing that worries me about HSAs very much so is that it just adds this additional layer of complexity to the workplace environment. I think a lot of employers don't even understand the ins and outs of these things. Quick personal story. So I'm on my wife's employer's health plan. And last year, for the first time, they introduced a high deductible insurance plan coupled with an HSA option. And we went over it with our planner and said, yeah, let's do that. So we're doing what I said. We're putting the money in there and trying not to use it. But in the meantime, when she goes to sign up for this thing, now my wife is 65 at the time, the HR department at her employer came back and said, oh, you can't contribute to an HSA because you're 65. And she reports this back to me. And I said, no, tell them that's wrong. It's true that you cannot continue to contribute to an HSA once you go on Medicare, but she was not going on Medicare because she's still working. And you can, the one reason you can delay going on Medicare with no problem of a late penalty is if you're still working full time and have insurance at work. And that was her situation. You need to stop contributing to the HSA 6 months before you go on Medicare, because of the look back in Part A. This is a good example of why this stuff is so – it's ridiculous how complicated some of this stuff is. Now, just put that aside for a sec. So we straightened that out, and I send in two or three articles I've done on this to her HR department, which they promptly ignore. But nonetheless, we get it straightened out. So they're introducing this benefit they don't even understand, okay? Now, put that off to the side and think about the challenges – that are going on in the workplace with just getting people to use the 401k to its best advantage. What kind of uptake has there been for the Roth K? Poor, right?
It's getting better.
Okay. Lots of employers have added it, but not that many people are using it. I'm just saying there's so much complexity in this environment already. Now we're adding more. Is it really necessary? Yeah. I can think of better ways to skin that cat.
Yeah,
I don't even know how we got off on all that, but I gave my rant
on HSAs.
We're
talking about ways to play catch up if you're running behind.
Oh, right. All right. So that's one side of the equation. Yeah. Save more. The other side I think that's really important is to give some creative thought to the spending side. So if you really have reached the point where you say, oh, gosh, I got close to retirement, I didn't do what I needed to do, you know, there are ways to re-engineer the cost side. Can you extract equity from your home, move to something less expensive? You really scrub the expense side. I think it's often overlooked. I've done a few articles over the years about ways to save lots of money by moving. Let's say you live in an expensive metro market, you know, New York, Chicago, Washington. You need to be close to where you're working. When you retire, that need to be close to your income source is not as strong. Could you move somewhere? Did a story a number of years ago about people who just didn't want to leave their city they're living in because that's where their friends, their family are.
Right.
But they moved to the edge of the metro area, you know, maybe still on a train line that lets them get into the city conveniently, but, you know, chopped their living expenses in half, took a bunch of equity out of maybe an expensive home in a central part of the city. So, you know, there are creative things one can do to scale back spending. And so that's the other thing that I would urge people to think about.
I want to talk a little bit more about spending because I think people can use it as a lever. But let's talk about the categories, what you see when you look at spending trends in retirement. What stuff do people spend more money on in retirement than they did when they were working? And the opposite, what do they spend less on in retirement than when they were working?
Well, it's more on healthcare.
Yes. And is that later in life or consistently through?
It tends to be later. I mean, probably weighted by near end of life, intense expenditures, or a long-term care need. But, you know, health expenses go up. Some things go down. You're not spending money on things like, you know, lunches during the work week and work clothing and commuting costs go down. There's a whole variety of things that can drop. We talked earlier about, so you have your discretionary bucket and non-discretionary. And the non-discretionary is your housing, utilities, food, transportation. The Senior Citizens League does an annual study where they have like a market basket of goods that seniors purchase. It's a non-discretionary bucket. You know, it's all the stuff like your home heating and your food and rent or property tax. They find that seniors have lost like 30% of their purchasing power over the last couple of decades just on the non-discretionary stuff. That feeds into this whole argument about inflation and whether the consumer price index does a good enough job of measuring the inflation that people are seeing.
Right.
So it's concerning.
Inflation hits older adults harder because of that healthcare component?
The healthcare component and, you know, fixed income at that point and erosion of purchasing power. Arguably, the cost of living adjustment in Social Security is not even adequate to that because of healthcare and some of these others. And then you have other sources that are not inflation protected at all. So if you're lucky enough to have a defined benefit pension, it's declining and its purchasing power is declining every year.
Some of the public sector pensions, I think, have inflation
adjustments.
Yes, some
adjustments. Do. Thank you. Good point.
So to counteract some of that, a tool it seems that some planners, advisors would recommend, and perhaps you've recommended in interacting with users, is an annuity. And mm-hmm. So are there a set of circumstances, a fact pattern, that, where you think it's more appropriate for somebody to consider using an annuity, and conversely others where it just doesn't make a lot of sense to pull that out of the bag?
Yeah, well, one worry about annuities is they're nominal. They're not inflation adjusted. Okay. So that's a concern. Yep. I've seen some interesting writing about that back and forth lately about from some retirement researchers, and I think David Blanchett was part of this too. There's some online articles about does it make sense to the additional cost of buying inflation protection in an annuity. And I think Blanchett's point was it's way too expensive, and others were saying, well, it can make sense, depends what your view of inflation is. Yeah. But all this is kind of a how many angels dance on a head of a pin kind of an argument, because yeah. The fact is annuities remain such a small part of the overall retirement landscape. People don't want them, generally speaking.
Why is that?
You know, I think people are really leery about handing over a big chunk of money for an uncertain return. Mm-hmm. I think it's that basic. And you can argue till you're blue in the face about longevity protection and how it can be beneficial. And I think there can be situations where it's beneficial. But to me, it's a lot like the difficulty of getting people to delay Social Security. And most people don't delay Social Security. You know, the bulk of people file below their retirement age or at it. And it's just another example of human behavior. It's just how we are wired. You know, show me the money now,
right.
I think is the – and I don't want to give up control. So, you know, it's a struggle. You know, and some categories of annuities are showing some growth, kind of these fixed rate instruments. But at the same time, others are going down. So the market, I think, overall is kind of flat. Mm-hmm. And it's a spec compared to like the 401k. You look at all assets in 401ks and IRAs and then compare that to all assets in annuities, and it's not even a comparison.
So speaking of 401ks, there was that SECURE Act that I believe passed yeah. through the House that would allow company retirement plans to offer annuities. That's been a contentious thing.
Yes.
First, let's talk about what that would mean. It seems like it's a little unclear about yeah. what type of annuities, but also what's your take on offering annuities in that context, or maybe even like auto-opting people into
sure.
them at some point.
So the legislation would create a safe harbor provision for the employer to protect them against the risk that an annuity provider that they bring into the plan goes out of business, you know, goes belly up down the road. So there's kind of an arm's length safe harbor. That's the big thing that's in there to try to encourage employers to add these things. Most people I talk to about it are skeptical that we'll see widespread adoption of that. I think there will probably be some. But I think to me it's similar to what we were discussing a minute ago about the already complex environment. We've got 401k, now HSA, and you know we now have this new wrinkle of converting to an annuity. It'll be interesting to watch, but I don't think it's going to be a big revolutionary change. Nobody in the annuity business is saying this is going to just change things overnight. And there are some big players in this business who just continue to feel like there's just no good rationale for doing it in the workplace as opposed to retail. Vanguard feels that way, I know. I would say, you know, I think workplace is where the rubber meets the road for so many people. So, you know, it's where you can get some focus and you can get some level of maybe some advice to the person approaching retirement. So I think there's always some value in focusing on what's going on in the workplace. So I'm always interested in that. But I'm kind of skeptical that annuities are going to suddenly take off in workplace retirement plans if this becomes law, which I think it will.
One topic that you've hit on a few times is just how complicated all this is, this process of retirement decumulation,
yes,
especially as it relates to the investment portfolio. So what are your best ideas in terms of simplifying mm-hmm. this whole thing to make it easier for people?
Yeah, I always tell people to, this is not revolutionary advice, but I'm a big believer in low-cost index investing, automation, target date fund. It's amazing to me, you know, as much as people like you, Christine, or me talk till we're blue in the face about these ideas, how many people just have not gotten the message. Having a conversation just last week, I was on a long drive with a really good old friend of mine who was telling me about this great investment advisor he's got, you know, it's a traditional, actively managed philosophy at work there. And he said, well, he just doesn't believe in these index funds. I said, well, of course he doesn't believe in these index funds because that's like killing his business. And, you know, there's a reason why Vanguard is sort of eating this business alive. And so I said, well, tell me about what kind of returns you're getting. And he says, oh, it's been really great. We're getting, you know, X to Y every year. And I said, is that after expenses? Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I said, well, how much is he charging you? Oh, I really don't know. So, you know, there's just kind of a comfort level that some people, they like the advisor, right? I just trust Joe. He's been great for me over the years. You know, he takes me out to play golf every year, to which I often say, that's the most expensive round of golf he will play this year. So, yeah, I think just more people need to get the message on the importance of keeping costs rock bottom, contribute regularly, start early. You know, young people ask me about this. If you start early, this is like the best thing you can do for yourself, even if it's a very small amount of money, into an inexpensive Roth IRA, let's say, target date fund, $1,000 a year starting in your 20s, you'll be so glad you did that with compounding in the out years. There's been some good research showing that that's like bigger than almost, you know, how much you put in, how early you start, much bigger than investment returns or anything else.
And so if you were retirement king or retirement czar,
yeah,
you know, and maybe we're focused on the retirement planning system itself, which I think that you've, you know, quite persuasively described as highly, highly complex,
yeah,
very diffuse, just hard for a participant to interact with. If you could wave a wand,
yeah,
right, and make some simplifications to those, mm-hmm, I mean, what would be the key things that you would focus on?
I would be in favor of a mandatory participation, highly automated system where all employers are required to be in.
Mm-hmm.
There's variations on this out there already with some, right, of these state plans.
Right.
There's some proposals that have been made for it at the national level too.
Yeah.
I think the retirement industry is increasingly seeing the wisdom of some automated mandatory thing. I think the word mandatory was just sort of poison in the wake of the passage of the Affordable Care Act. It just became this political third rail.
Right.
But a lot of the folks I talk to in the industry now are coming around to the idea that, hey, something mandatory is what we need. Where everybody's in, you need portability, so when people move from job to job, it's not too complicated. You know, all the things we know are working, like automatic enrollment, auto escalation, low cost. I think we could do ourselves a lot of good with something like that. And then I also am a big believer in, I would expand Social Security. I would be in favor of higher taxes going in for higher benefits across the board, because, you know, I think with the exception of the Warren Buffetts of the world, we could all use more guaranteed income through retirement. Social Security is an efficient system, works great, and we could help a lot of people with just getting more income to them that's guaranteed for life.
We've really enjoyed this conversation, full of insights. Mark, thanks again for taking the time to be on the Long View with us.
Oh, it was really a pleasure. Thanks so much, Jeff. Thanks, Christine.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for joining us on the Long View. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to and rate The Longview for Morningstar on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can follow us on Twitter at Christine_Benz.
And at SYouth1, which is SYouth and the number 1. Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Patak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.